Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Risky Business. My name's Patrick Gray. I, of course, just took a couple of weeks off for the school holidays here in New South Wales, Australia, and forgot to tell you all I was taking a break, which led to a few emails saying, did you just retire or what's going on? But no, we are back on deck, and we've got a great show for you today to catch up on all of the news of the last few weeks. This week's edition of the show is brought to you by Panther, and in this week's sponsor interview, I'm joined by Panther. There's Casey Hill, and we're going to be talking about the future of SIEM, really, because SIEMs are not really about firewall logs these days. We're talking high volume log sources and things like that, huge volumes of data. The SIEMs of the future are going to have to deal with that. So Casey's joining us to talk through all of that. But first up, of course, it's time for a check of the week's news with Adam Boileau. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Pat. It's nice to have you back.
It's good to be back. But I must say I had a wonderful break. Took the family to Brisbane, which is a terrific city. Did some camping as well out in the wilderness, swimming in beautiful rivers. And it was very good. But
not thinking about computers.
I actually managed it. But it is good to be back. And we do have, of course, after any break, we've got a pile of stuff to get through. Let's start with this salt typhoon story. It looks like some Chinese APT actors managed to gain access into at least some components of some American telco like Kalia interception rigs. The reaction on social media seems to be, well, oh, they must have been using this stuff to do wiretaps on Americans. But if you actually parse the reporting carefully, it looks like the chief concern here is that they would have been able to identify who, like the FBI, might have been wiretapping. So from a sort of counterintelligence perspective, that's what the Chinese might have been up to, as opposed to trying to, task wiretaps on people. Is that your reading as well?
Yeah, that seems to make sense. The the early reporting talked about three telcos. I think it was AT&T, Verizon, and Lumen. But subsequent reporting has talked about, 10 to 12. And if you're going to break in, if you're going to task lawful intercept, then, you kind of need more access, and those systems are going to be different between the different telcos. So doing that across a dozen telcos is a lot of work. Doing two or three, I can imagine, would make sense. But the way it's being described, the idea that they had access to a system that could see who was being intercepted or who was being monitored, that's more believable, because some of those could be shared. They could be, that's kind of a lesser degree of access. So I think your theory makes sense with, as a slightly closer reading of the reporting so far. But, either way, access to lawful intercept, is a thing that, A, very powerful, B, a traditional target of intelligence agencies. We've seen these be targeted by Western intelligence agencies, going back quite a long way.
Well, and by China previously in Operation Aurora, all the way back in whenever that was, 2008, 2009.
It's going back. So, these are long, sort of traditional targets of intelligence people, and it kind of makes sense that they're a little bit, the government in the US is a little bit worried about it. But some of the rhetoric around this on social media has been a little bit doolally, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, I mean, people are saying look, these are the risks of legal interception and whatever, and it's okay, it is a risk, right? But are we going to argue seriously that the FBI shouldn't be able to tap phones with a warrant? Is that your argument?
Which seems
a bit silly. And my question is, if they weren't tasking wiretaps with these systems, why not? Is it that they were scared they were going to get caught because there's solid auditing in place, or did they just not have that level of access? I'm really curious, or whether or not that just wasn't the brief, right? But I'm hungry for more details on this one.
Yes. Let's put it that way. Yeah, exactly. I had exactly that reaction. I want to see the meaty details of what they were doing, how they were doing it, in what systems. Because, getting to the point where you can see lawful intercept, tasking or selectors or whatever else, that's kind of one thing. But getting to the point where you can make your own requests or get the data out of existing requests, is a bit more involved. And, if you get to the point where you've got, root or admin or, sort of maintenance level gear, access to the gear that's doing it, then obviously, the kind of the world is your oyster. But there are a whole, like any other IT system, right, there are a whole other level of, you know, systems involved and places where the data gets put out to, and web portals for putting in the requests in, and authorization by legal. And, you know, there's a bunch of places where you could get into these systems, and they're all interesting. And yeah. I'm nosy about all of it.
Well, I feel like maybe they got access to the portals where people submit the paperwork, the warrants, right? Like, that's what this feels like based on the reporting, but ultimately we don't know. I should also point out, too, that it's not just American telcos. No other countries have come forward to sort of acknowledge that their telcos had these problems, but they have said it's not just America. But they're the ones talking about it right now, which is a positive. You know, this does raise questions about sort of lawful intercept against other technologies. Say WhatsApp were to provide some sort of, you know, Kalia-like, you know, intercept capability to intelligence and law enforcement. You know, we could see attacks against that sort of infrastructure. But again, is the argument that we shouldn't do any level of targeted surveillance because this might happen? I don't think that's necessarily an argument that stacks up, if I'm honest. But perhaps we do need to consider what sort of scale these interceptions should run at, because the larger the scale, the more potential for this sort of thing happening and being very bad is.
Yeah, you know, the bigger the collection, the more kind of collateral damage there can be. And I think, you know, you're right to say, you know, this is not just telcos anymore. Like, this particular case might be, we don't know. But, you know, there are so many other communications mechanisms, and there's so many problems in how we provision that access. And you know, all of the things we have, you know, the challenges we have in regular computers, like identity and authorization, all those sorts of things matter. And I mean, a while ago, you had like a sponsor interview or a snake oilers or something with a guy that was running like authentication for lawful intercept requests as a service business.
That was just for like all sorts of requests, not just interception, right? So that was like for dealing with law enforcement. So if you're a company that has to manage law enforcement requests, it's sort of like bug bounties, but for that. They deal with them for you and can tell you, well, yeah, this person is legit, or this person, we've never seen them before. And then they can go out and verify. Can't remember the name of the company. Sorry.
Yeah.
sponsor, but that was very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the sort of, you know, those sort of problems exist in this infrastructure. And that's kind of a, regardless of how we, you know, position lawful intercept as a thing that is good for society or not, like, those problems are still going to exist regardless of how we try and solve those trade-offs.
Yeah.
And then the other kind of part of this argument against it is, like, if we're talking about national intelligence agencies here, the Chinese going after Americans or whoever else, the idea that not having this infrastructure would make them decide not to then go and use it. Like, if you can break into the gear underneath, it doesn't matter if there's lawful intercept or not.
You just do your own intercept.
Just
a few more hops, right? I just looked it up, by the way, and the company's name is Codex. But at this point, Adam, we're going to have to move on from this quickly. Yes. But I did want to ask you to share with the class, because one of my favorite war stories from your days as a penetration tester was when you actually did some testing on an interception system, which was very well set up, and you still got it in the end. And I want you to tell the class how you got it, because this is a story that back then, when it was more recent, you know, had to be told quietly, usually after we had you at a conference and filled enough beer into you, right? Like, I could poke you and get you to tell the story, because it's a great one. But if you would share with the class, I sure would appreciate it, because it's been long enough now.
I mean, it's been a long time. So I was tasked with lawful intercepts. Well, actually, to be fair, I was tasked with breaking into important bits of some telco infrastructure, and lawful intercept seemed like the right thing to go for. So I went for lawful intercept, got there, you know, without too much drama, wrote it up in the report, shipped it off. Turned out that I had got the test lawful intercept system, which I thought was production, and I was embarrassed, and they all were like, you know, you didn't get what you said you did, son, you know, blah, 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 you know, talk down to me a little bit. And so I had a bee in my bonnet about getting to production lawful intercept the next time against that same target. And this involved me breaking into the camera systems for all their data centers, so I could see inside the physical data centers, try and find the racks, try and find the actual equipment that I wanted to get to, because this stuff was behind biometric auth in dedicated rooms with like really robust controls. And eventually, after I had compromised all the desktops of the people that, you know, loaded up the warrants, et cetera, I learned I found all their process documents. I figured out how they did it. And it involved like getting a laptop out of a safe and signing out the crypto keys and two-man rule and all sorts of like in a secured room. It, you know, they had really done it well. And so I was, you know, I was frustrated. Eventually I got there by finding like the data center design documentation, and I found the documentation for how they did the physical install of the gear in the racks. And it included top of rack management with serial consoles. And it turned out that as a standard rule, they plugged in the serial consoles to these top of rack management units. And I went and looked at the cameras and I could see the cables.
So you basically wound up jumping an air gap over serial.
I jumped the air gap via a serial connection using creds that I had stolen from the desktops of the people that used the gear but didn't have access without going through all these hoops. And I got there in the end on the console, root access to production lawful intercept. And at that point, it took me a long time.
Like, yeah, but it was a matter of like you having a bee in your bonnet and something to prove.
Well, exactly. And it may be a character flaw that, that proving someone that I can do it was the thing that motivated me for like whatever it was, 9-10 weeks of fairly robust hacking, to be honest.
Yeah.
But I got there in the end.
Probably went a little bit overboard on that one, but yeah, just such a good story that I'm happy you can now share with class. So that's good. All right, we should move on to other stories because we've got a lot to get through this week. The Internet Archive had a data breach impacting some 30 million plus users, and then they're getting DDoSed. It looks like it's a group of Russians who are claiming to be motivated by the Palestinian cause. And my first question, because I did drop into Slack briefly when this was going on, and I'm like, what are you going to do with this data? I can't imagine that it's that sensitive. And you pointed out, well, it's just a really good corpus of passwords, but aren't they like bcrypted?
Yeah, they're pretty well hashed, so it probably isn't the world's most useful password corpus, but 31 million, like, you're still going to get enough that fall out, even at bcrypt speeds, to be useful for something.
What are bcrypt speeds these days? Because it used to be just non-viable, like, not that long ago.
Like, dictionary is viable, like, not huge dictionary, but, like, so, like, in the thousands a second, I think. But, there's a bunch of settings depending on how you configure your bcrypt, but, like, it's viable for dictionary words, but not much beyond that. And this has been loaded up into Have Our Own Pwn, so a bunch of people have got notifications. But, overall, I feel like going after the Internet Archive is just puppy kicking. It's rude.
It is like what, but they're like, it's American and the Americans support the Israelis, so down with the Internet Archive. It's like, okay, right. This seems like one of those reverse engineered justifications after they found Shell, right?
Yeah, it does. Just, because the Internet Archive does so much really good work, and I feel bad for them having to deal with this kind of BS. But hey, that's the internet that we live in.
That's just how it be, right?
It is.
And also, just a funny note, the BBC, in just one paragraph in like a news brief, accidentally reported that the hackers were called Have I Been Pwned? And we're published, like, it was just so funny. So Troy's like,
You bad man.
Do I know anyone at BBC who can take care of this? I'm sure it's sorted out like by now, or very much on the way to being sorted out. The other thing that I wanted to talk, another thing I wanted to talk about today is Microsoft's latest big threat report, huge document, 100 plus pages, some interesting stuff in it. There's always interesting stuff in these big Microsoft reports. One of the most interesting things, and that's what Catalan really zeroed in on for his coverage with us, was the fact that China and Russia are increasingly relying on criminal tools and criminals themselves to get stuff done. So I do think that's a very interesting trend because, that wasn't always clear. And it didn't really look like it was happening, I don't know, necessarily all that much, but it's becoming clearer and clearer that this is becoming a strategy, which is interesting because, we're used to it going the other way, right? Which is early sort of cyber capabilities are cobbled together from odds and ends, including criminals and whatever. China did this famously with their nationalist hackers 20 years ago. But now it looks like they're sort of moving back in that direction. So that's interesting. The other thing, though, now, this is really weird because they've done a terrible job on their ransomware section. Terrible. So what they've done is they've argued that successful encryption in ransomware attacks is down, but ransomware encounters are up by 2.75x. But, you know, the ones that actually successfully deploy encryption, very, very low. Now, the problem I've got is they've said that there's been a threefold decrease in ransom attacks reaching encryption stage. How do you decrease something by threefold? Does that mean it starts at 100 and then winds up at minus 200? Are ransomware actors going around and unransoming people? How does this work, right? And then they've got a chart crime in here where one axis, you know, one y-axis is the absolute number of organizations having these ransomware account encounters. And the right-hand y-axis is the percentage of organizations ransomed. The highest record, it goes from 0 to 100, but the highest level looks like it's about 3%. So you can't really tell anything from that chart. Like, it's a mess. And, you know, AJ Vicens, by the way, congratulations to him because he's moving on from CyberScoop and he's got a job at Reuters. And I know AJ and he's a great journo and that's fantastic news, mate. Well done. But, you know, he had to write in his deck for CyberScoop's coverage on this that they're down by 300%. Like, what does that mean? Tell me.
That's a very good question. And like, I started reading the doc because, you know, you posted that graph in Slack and I was curious as well. And like, it's a great doc, but it's so dense, right? There's so many things to read in there and trying to figure out exactly what they mean by, because they've got a call out for a threefold decrease, but trying to get to the bottom of what that actually means, what they're trying to say.
Is that in absolute numbers? Is that in percentages? And what does threefold mean?
Yes.
Does it mean it's reduced by two thirds or by minus 300%, which is what, I'm just so confused at it. You'd expect a bit better, wouldn't you?
I mean, you would, but I mean, overall, like, they've done really great work. There's lots of great stuff on here and good insights and good data and so on. But yeah, that was definitely.
But the thing that I'm left with here is, has the successful number of encryptions, has the absolute number gone down by a significant margin or just the rate? Because we know that there's been an increase in encounters. So I don't know. I'm just frustrated by this because I'm left not really understanding what they're trying to say. You know?
Yeah, no, I share your frustration there. And, you know, I we have a long history in this industry of bad stats and bad numbers and bad decision-making. And, you know, you can just make up anything and put it on the slide and it'll be fine.
Well, I'm sure it's rooted in something. They just haven't expressed it well. You know, among our customers, Microsoft observed a 2.75x increase year over year in human-operated ransomware-linked encounters, defined as having at least one device targeted for a ransomware attack in a network. Meanwhile, the percentage of attacks reaching actual encryption phase has decreased over the past 2 years by threefold. So that's the percentage decrease. Threefold? What? Anyway, but they do say automatic attack disruption contributed to this positive trend, and they also pointed out that unmanaged devices are the ones that get ransomware. So I'm going to chalk that up to being a win for EDR, basically.
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, overall, the trends in this are actually pretty reassuring in a way.
Yeah.
Like the fact that it is, you know, weird outlier unmanaged stuff and human driven. Like all the automated stuff really hasn't survived the last few years' improvements. So I mean, you know, we are making progress slowly, but you know, is it enough? Probably not.
Now, we got some reporting from Darina Antonyuk over at The Record and also from our very own colleague Catalin Kimpanu, looking at an attack by Ukrainians against Russia's court system that actually looks pretty devastating.
Yes, it looked like the BO team, which is some kind of, you know, hacktivist crew that seems to cooperate with Ukrainian intelligence services, hacked the computers of the justice system over there that runs the courts and so on, deleted all their servers and appeared to have deleted all their backups, according to some reporting from Catalin. They are dead in the water for a little bit. They're saying they're going to build out a new system to run their courts, and you know, that may happen at some point later this month, but Ukraine's definitely been whacking Russia pretty hard with some of this, you know, kind of hacktivist sort of stuff.
Yeah, couldn't have happened to a nicer bunch of people, right? You know? Basically. So, you know, that one looks like it will really gum up the works and just make things tough. Obviously, none of this stuff really moves the needle in a war like this, but it is a level of harassment that people are going to feel. Staying in Ukraine as well, Ilya Vichuk, who has been on this show, he ran cyber for SBU. There were some corruption allegations made against him earlier this year. He wound up being sent to the front, and then I think he was fired from his post by the president. The anti-corruption organization in Ukraine has essentially cleared him of having more wealth than he should. They found no discrepancies between the value of the property owned by Vichuk and his family and the legitimate income that could indicate an unjustified acquisition of assets. So it looks like, I mean, I'm guessing he's going to be cycled back into a senior intelligence position.
Yeah, I would imagine so. And, you know, it seems like he's been pretty effective in the roles that he's done so far. And, you know, I guess if he's been cleared, then good for him. And, you know, it'd be nice to be back in an office instead of out in a trench or wherever it was that he got posted to.
Yeah. I mean, no word on, there were other allegations made that he'd attempted to have the journalists who were looking at him, like, mobilized to the front. There's been no update on that, but, you know, I think it certainly looks like, you know, he's in the clear by the looks of things. So we'll just have to see what, you know, what, where he pops up again. So yeah, good one to circle back on. Let's see, the Trump campaign. This is interesting, actually. Donald Trump's election campaign is using some specialized secure phones from a company based in California called Green Hill Software, and they've been around a while. And it looks like really what they're using is an ultra slimmed down sort of Android, ultra slimmed down Android devices, which seems to be the approach when you want this sort of specialized hardware. I just thought this was interesting that, you know, election campaigns have kind of learned the lesson, especially with all of the heat Trump in particular is facing from the Iranians. It makes sense that they'd do this.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, the sort of bigger questions for, you know, like, is this a thing that governments should provide for political parties more generally? Like, should this be table stakes for being a major political party? Like, that you get some kind of technical support, or you have to go fund it yourself and buy this off the shelf? And is that appropriate? But the Green Hill Software make a bunch of, like, embedded real-time operating systems for, you know, military aircraft and ships and equipment like that. So they are pretty mature in, you know, that kind of very robust computing space. Whether they're Android, you know, is kind of up to that level. Like, you know, it's hard to build a mobile phone that lets you truth social at the same time as being robust, right? But they have some things where, like, groups of users that use these phones can only communicate with each other, so presumably there's some kind of network level controls to try and make it not more generally reachable from the internet. So I'm sure there are a bunch of really smart things you can do, but on the other hand, political campaigns do got to get out there and communicate with people, and, you know, there are humans in the loop too, so, you know, hopefully it makes things better for them. But
Yeah, you know, I mean, we don't need
a hard problem to solve.
Nobody needs, like, even non-Americans, we don't need interference in the US election. You know what I mean? The United States is an important country. So I think it's good if this helps the Trump campaign lock stuff down. That's good for everybody, even people who don't support him.
Yeah, agree.
Now, on to one of my favorite stories this week. I got two favorites. This is definitely one of them. And surprised it didn't get more attention, to be honest. But the FBI ran a sting in the crypto space that is just so funny. They actually set up their own crypto token, and it's called, what is it? NexFundAI, right? So this was a sting operation. So they set up this token and posed as people who'd created this token and went out to all of these sort of consultants and crypto companies and said, what can you do to help our token succeed? And the answer among all of these companies universally was crimes. We can do crimes for you. Let's do some crimes. Pay us here. And here are the crimes we're going to commit to for you. And they committed the crimes and, like, did a bunch of wash trading and market manipulation on these FBI crypto tokens. And now they've all been indicted. It's so funny.
It's a beautiful thing.
It really is.
And the United States, like, DOJ put out the, you know, details of the indictment or whatever, and there's, like, meme pictures of Pepe pumping it up in there from their internal chat from some of the companies that were doing these pump and dumps. So, you know, it's very hard to look at a thing like this and not feel like the entire crypto ecosystem is just one big crime scam. Like, if you know you are struggling at this point to find a legitimate use for cryptocurrency anywhere, I think. And the fact that anyone who provides any services around it in the end is just going to be doing crimes, you know, I'm happy for some people to get their comeuppance. So
it is hard to find.
Good job.
It is hard to find legitimate uses. Like, it really is. Ones that matter, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, even for international remittance, like, that's so easy these days. I mean, you know, we're an Australia-based company that has US-based customers with employees in Australia, New Zealand, and Romania. And it's not a problem, right? It would cost me more to send this money via crypto than it does through, you know, normal fiat services. So, yeah, anyway, that's just how it is. Okay, now we're into the enterprise crapware part of the discussion. Talk to me about the criticals in Fortinet products that are everywhere, the criticals in Palo Alto, the comedy bugs in a Palo Alto product called Expedition, and also what's going on with Avanti. Let's just combine this into one globule of horror.
Horrific fail, yes. So there are, I think, four bugs in Fortinet products that are on the CISA Kev list now, as of the most recent update to that. Some of the bugs are funny, of course. One of them is like a straight up format string in the management service, which is a beautiful, just, you know, like, what year is it that there are exploitable format string bugs? So that's a good time. There's a write up we've linked through to from Watchtower Labs, which is a like very sassy write up of them reverse engineering one of these bugs so that they can implement detection for it in their products. And they talk through all of the just deep comedy involved in looking in the gubbins of Fortinet products. The Palo Alto one, though, like, I had this one, and you linked it to me after you got back. You were meant to be on holiday and not looking at computers, but anyway, you linked
this one. I can't believe you missed this one, man, because it was so funny. It was just like, what was it? It was, like, you can whack a cron job into a GET request and just fire. And it doesn't.
So this is, it was a set of bugs in a product called Palo Alto Expedition, which no one has ever heard of, which is their tool for migrating other vendors' firewalls to Palo Alto. So, like, it's a, like, web app that you install on some, you know, like, Linux VM or whatever, and then you log into it, give it creds for all of your old devices and your new Palos, and it migrates configs across for you. And if you were silly enough to put this on the internet, which some people are, then it was comedy bugs all the way down. There was a thing where you could, like, unauth reset the password to Palo Alto, and then from there bootstrap your way up with a cron job for command exec and some SQL injection and steal creds and clear text passwords for the devices that you are going to migrate. So if you have this thing on the internet and you've used it, people can just compromise all of your other devices. And according to Shodan, at least 23 people have put this thing on the internet. So bad news bears for them.
Yeah, I mean, you say on the internet, sure. But I mean, even internally.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you want some persistence? I mean,
You want some lawful intercept access? Yeah, I mean, yeah, like, any, if someone can see one of these things, then yes, you are definitely going to have a bad time. And it's just like, come on, Palo, really. And this thing is all written in PHP, which is one of the reasons that, like, some of these bugs are just terrible, because there's bad, you know, SQL query construction and, you know, making cron jobs with no auth, and it's just, yeah, dumb.
Yeah.
So bad Palo, no biscuit.
Yeah, and more of Avanti drama as well.
And yet more Avanti dramas. So, yeah, I think maybe Avanti was the one that had four entries on CISA Care rather than Fortinet. But either way, bad times if you have that on the outside of your network. But by this point, like, if you have an Avanti cloud service, whatever it's called, cloud service manager, like, you must be used to either patching it or doing incident response by now. And either way, you must be pretty polished at both. So
that's a glass half full. I mean, think about what Avanti is doing for the state of the art in incident response, you know? Gotta think about that.
Plus, the state of the wallets of all of the incident responders. So, yeah, good job. Thanks, Avanti. All my incident response pals chuckling it up all the way to the bank.
Now, I mentioned that I had two favorite stories this week. This is my other favorite, where this person's written it up. He claims to be a guy called Daniel, who's 15 years old. Obviously, I haven't reached out to confirm this, but we'll just take it on faith that this is a 15-year-old bug hunter. You know, does a bit of bug hunting in his spare time. And he found this bug in Zendesk, which would allow you to sort of extract tickets, right? And because they weren't doing validation, the correct amount of email validation and whatnot, right? So he reports it to him and they're like, yeah, go away. This is out of scope. We don't care. So then he figures out how to turn this bug into like access to a company's Slack and then starts reporting it to those end users of Zendesk. And he makes like 50 grand in bounties. And at this point, that's when Zendesk threw HackerOne circle back and they're like, well, hey, maybe you just want to stop, you know, talking about this and stop doing these things. And eventually they patched it. They didn't give him a bounty because he took it like he violated HackerOne's confidentiality, even though they weren't going to patch it in the first place. Anyway, the whole thing, just as a story, is hilarious. End result, though, is this kid gets 50K. Zendesk look like idiots because they kind of blew him off when they shouldn't have. And, you know, if I'm those customers who had to pay up bounties on this for a bug that was already reported to them by the same person, I'm thinking I'm going to ask Zendesk for, you know, my money back, basically, at this point. Like, what did you think of all of this?
I mean, I always love a great disclosure drama. That's, you know, a bug reporting drama. That's always fun. And this, you know, my experience of reporting bugs kind of mirrors this. You end up with, you know, a bug being triaged, you know, to the letter of the law of the bug bounty program. In this case, like the bug basically involves spoofing email, and Zendesk's bug bounty program with HackerOne excluded like DKIM and SPF and other email issues. And that's because there are so many people who spam every bug bounty program in the world with bogus SPF and DKIM, you know, reports that are pointless and add no value. So they just put that on the like out of scope. But in this case, you know, you should have looked at this bug and triaged it a little more sensibly, in my opinion. Yeah. So, you know, in that respect.
Well, my favorite part is where the HackerOne people came back and they're like, but you didn't tell us you could use it to do, you know, for like Slack takeover. It's like, well, you know, use your imaginations.
Yeah, and I mean, that's kind of what you're paying HackerOne for, is to be able to make sensible triage choices. And I have a lot of sympathy with people who do bug bounty triage for HackerOne and other places like that.
Well, it's hard to do at scale, right? Which is why that whole industry exists in the first place. So, I mean, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, that person doing triage was terrible and whatever, you know, because it happens, like, as you point out. But still, like, this, we can still chalk this one up as a miss.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think maybe they could have given the kid a little bit more money rather than just saying $0.
Yeah, they took their bat and ball and went home in a huff, basically, which, not exactly classy. But, you know, if you're one of the Zendesk customers who paid a bounty to this kid, I'd be asking for some free licensing in the equivalent value to what you paid out on this, because that's, you know, come on.
Yeah, agreed.
Now, I don't know if this is disclosure drama, just some stuff that got mixed up, lost in translation or whatever. There was a bunch of reporting that a recently patched Firefox O-Day was being exploited in the wild against Tor browser users. And that's how the reporting went. Gruck even had a good joke about it, which is like, well, if you got O-Day in Firefox, who else are you going to use it against, right? So that was good. But, you know, and I think this came from the Tor project itself saying that, you know, this bug could be used in that way. I don't know where the miscommunication started, but that's what all the reporting was. And in the end, Tor's come out and said, oh, we've got actually no evidence that it was reported in the wild. And Mozilla's come out and said no. So it looks like that was all a big nothing burger.
Yeah, like Mozilla said they had seen it being exploited in the wild, but not specifically against Tor browser. And then at some point, wires got crossed and that got, you know, kind of claimed that it was against Tor browser after all. I think maybe by the Tails people, which are part of Tor project these days. So yeah, in the end, I think Gruck really has the point here, which is that it may not be confirmed that it was being used against Tor browser, but I mean, what else are you going to use it for? So either way, you know, if you rely on Tor browser, you should definitely patch your Firefox frequently.
Yeah, indeed. Now, we got a report here from Dan Gooden at Ars about some malware that looks like it's designed to hop air gaps. It's being attributed to Russia.
Yeah, this was for some research from ESET following up on a piece of malware that was, I think, originally written by Kaspersky. And this was, you know, an intelligence crew that was doing air gap jumping, collecting data and exfilling it back out through USB keys. And this particular actor has been doing this with, I think, a whole, you know, kind of basically two separate tool chains over a number of years. And ESET wrote it up, having found it in a South Asian embassy in Belarus. And, you know, the malware itself, you know, the actual air gap jumping part of it, like the USB infection, is, if you know, it's one of those, it's not dumb if it works, but it's kind of dumb. But the rest of the tooling all is, you know, pretty polished for doing what it needs to do. And it's, you know, always interesting to see a good write-up of these. But, you know, I don't know, you know, we haven't really seen it in widespread. Like, it's not a thing that most people need to worry about, because most people aren't worried about USB air gap jumping malware. But still legit interesting to read the details.
Yeah, yeah. And one more we got here from Krebs on security. Brian Krebs has, this is an interesting report, actually, because it, you know, you and I have been talking about this before we got recording, and it's just proof that people will always find a way to monetize vulnerable systems, right? And he's got this report here where attackers are essentially reselling access to large language models. So they're taking over, like, you know, commercial LLMs, and then reselling that access to people so they can have, like, AI girlfriends that are like children and like bleh, bleh. But yeah. You know, the interesting part for the purposes of our discussion here are that, yeah, I mean, if they can breach it, they'll monetize it, right? It reminds me of, like, back in the day when people would get illicit access to telcos, and then they'd plug that access into, like, a calling card system, and they'd sell calling cards. So, you know, you'd sell someone, you know, 100 minutes for $20 or whatever, and they would use it until you got evicted. And then what are they going to do? Get their money back. But this is how you would get, you know, discounted calling back in the day. So this is interesting, isn't it, that people are stealing access to LLMs. You know, we see people steal compute for things like crypto mining, and now they're selling access to, you know, compromised LLMs, and they're taking some of the safeguards off them to allow them to be used for this purpose. And, you know, that's a whole new criminal cottage industry.
Yeah, it is. It's the, you know, so much of what we report on follows the ability to monetize. And, you know, that's where ransomware was, you know, so innovative, was it was a way to monetize access to computer systems, where previously CPU crypto mining or, you know, end user kind of consumer ransomwaring, you know, which didn't make particularly much money. So anywhere where we see innovation in extracting value from hacking is going to push, you know, the trends in the crime world. And I just thought this was really interesting because exactly that, stealing access to LLMs or anything else where, you know, a bunch of AI resource, be it at runtime or building model time, can be stolen and monetized, then, you know, we'll see new crime types. So, you know, in this case, it was like Amazon, people who used Amazon's things were having their compute stolen. I think researchers from Permiso leaked their tokens on GitHub or wherever to wait and see what would happen. And then they watched, and that's how they kind of tracked down who was stealing their, you know, was losing their Amazon account and where it was ending up being used to run, you know, sex chatbots or whatever else. But, you know, probably higher value than CPU crypto mining. So, yeah, innovative. Good job.
Criminals. Well, you can't crypto mine with an LLM, really. Like, they can't even do basic multiplication, as it turns out. It's funny, actually. Permiso were just in our last round of snake oilers, the last batch. And, yeah, they're ex-FireEye people. They're pretty smart folks.
You got that impression.
yeah. So, I mean, it's just bizarre. It's just, what a world. Before we go, though, there's a long read that you wanted to talk about. It's a report from the Washington Post called The Cyber Sleuth, and looks at an IRS investigator who does blockchain stuff. And you say this one's a really good long read.
Yeah, it's a very long read, and it's actually written by a fiction author. You know, it's a nonfiction story, but written by a fiction author. So it's quite a nice piece of prose. And if you have, you know, friends or acquaintances or whatever, and they're trying to explain, you know, what it is you do if you're a blockchain investigator or crypto criminals or whatever else, you know, worth sharing to them. But it's the story of this guy that's an IRS investigator. It also ties in with a bunch of other people, like that guy that's currently being held in Zimbabwe or wherever it was, Nigeria. The guy was being held in Nigeria that used to be an IRS investigator and then, you know, is being held political prisoner there. That, you know, there's just a bunch of interesting bits that touch on things we've talked about. So if you want a lunchtime read, I would definitely recommend giving it a go.
All right, well, I'll whack a link in this week's show notes. But Adam Boileau, that is it for this week's news. We've managed to keep it pretty tight, considering we've been on break for a while. But we were very brutal in organising this week's run sheet, and it's paid yes. dividends because the show's not an hour and a half. So that's great, mate. But, yeah, we'll wrap it up there, and I look forward to speaking to you again next week.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. I will talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Casey Hill, who is a product manager at Panther. And Panther makes one of these sort of more newfangled, detection as code-based SIEMs, more cutting edge than the stuff we're seeing out of the likes of Google and Microsoft, who are kind of doing cloud Splunk, if you want to describe it really. Panther's much more about doing high volume logs and whatnot. And this conversation with Casey is an interesting one. It's really about how, there are new models coming out for SIEM, basically. Over the last few years, we've seen people, various companies encourage people to set up data lakes and just put all your logs in a data lake. And then what do you do from there? What, query it with SQL? Like, that hasn't worked out so well. So Panther's sort of somewhere in the middle of those approaches, where they can help you set up those data lakes and then really help you to query them and build detections and things like that. But Casey joined me for this conversation really about those SIEM trends and what the SIEM of the future is going to look like. I hope you enjoy this interview.
2 years ago, we were pretty early in the space. So there were a lot of homegrown solutions where people were starting to look at how they could play with some of the new data storage mechanisms like data lakes and push all their data there and then leverage things like SQL to search through it. But what we've seen is more and more folks are starting to transition in this way, and it's not just homegrown solutions anymore. So we've seen other competitors start to really emulate a lot of things that we're doing around some of the infrastructure, as well as leveraging things like Python so that you can run real-time streaming detections.
I mean, I remember the whole data lake thing, right? And everyone was like, it reminds me of that old joke, right? Like, step one, stick everything in a data lake. Step two, question marks. Step three, stop attackers, right? Like, it always seemed like that whole thing was more being driven by your sort of Elastics and Snowflakes of the world, which as a way to sell their product, right? Which is just throw all of your logs in here and figure out what to do with them later. I mean, is that approach just throw everything into a data lake and like think of something later? Is that dead and buried yet?
I would say that is not fully dead and buried, but it is on its way. I think one of the things that we've actually seen is some competitors even look at things as, oh, either we can throw it in the data lake for you, or if it's already in your data lake, that's fine, we'll just sit on top of it. But that's actually a huge challenge, is if you don't actually have the data structured in a way that makes sense and is actually useful for you to then analyze, then you're just spending time elsewhere in terms of cleaning that data up and making sure that you have good data hygiene.
But Casey, the pamphlet told me that I didn't need to structure the data. That's the whole point of having a data lake.
Exactly, right? It's just supposed to magically work itself into the shape that you need it and draw patterns across it for you.
Yeah, exactly. So okay, you mentioned that you were early to this party. Others, are they taking a similar sort of approach now, which is it's about, yeah, getting things into some sort of sensible form when they're stored, so that you can like run some standard queries and detections on it? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is there a bit of a consensus for what, future SIEM should look like? Because for the last few years, it's kind of looked like, backstory from Google and Sentinel from Microsoft. But I guess at least with those, those major platforms, they've got the option to move in this direction as well in the future. But yeah, I'm just really trying to get a sense for where the innovation's going here.
Yeah, so we've seen, obviously, platform play has become extremely important across both just security vendors, but then obviously the cloud providers, as it's an easy tack on. We're looking at security leaders are often looking for, how do I consolidate different things, especially if I have a number of different point solutions. But one of the things that we consistently see where customers are coming to us or prospects are coming to us and they're having frustrations with some of those is usually it's a little bit clunky. So One is just the ability to actually set up, the ability to ultimately get that data in the structure that you need it, and then the ability to ingest data that's not within that particular cloud environment is another piece. And so ultimately ownership has become a really important thing for a number of our customers, is they want to have more flexibility about not just what data they're ingesting, but ultimately how it gets stored and where they can actually take that data with them after either they've decided they need it only for compliance purposes after the fact, or they might want to be able to have some sort of flexibility with ultimately the data store.
So do you actually have customers who are using you to take like application logs and whatever, whip them into something sensible and then pump that onwards into those platforms that I mentioned? Is that a use case?
So we see some customers will do, they'll basically bifurcate certain data. So they'll say, okay, I want to keep all my security data continuing to go into Snowflake, for example, with Panther. And then I also want to duplicate data into, say, like S3, so that I can keep it there for compliance purposes. So for example, I might say, okay, this is for PCI compliance. I need to go ahead and store this, but I'm not regularly accessing this. And so I just want to dump this into...
need to check the box. So when the auditor comes around and says, where is this data? You say, there it is in that bucket over there. And they say yes, and they tick the form.
Yep, exactly. You know how that goes.
Yeah, I do. I guess what I was asking though is more whether or not people are using stuff like Panther as a sort of hop point, right, between the application and some of these newer cloud seams from the likes of Google and Microsoft.
So we'll see, not as much in terms of like if you're saying downstream consumption into like a Google Chronicle or a Microsoft.
Yeah.
We don't see that as much. We actually see more like questions around, especially with some GCP customers recently, of, okay, how can I either run Panther within GCP so that I can actually use up some of the credits that I've already purchased there? Or how can I use it as a sort of side-by-side so that things that I need either high volume or I need really quick response, those will be different workloads that they'll actually transfer over sometimes from like a Chronicle into Panther so that they have more of the real-time analysis and they can also do so in a more cost-effective manner.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I asked, right? Because as I said, like it looked for a while like, oh, we'd worked out what the future of Seam was going to be, and it was basically going to be like Cloud Splunk. Right, which was a bit of a disappointment, really, when you look at the the next iteration of a Seam is like, well, it's like the same thing, but it's in the cloud now. That's why I was wondering, just where that fits among the type of customers who are, using your stuff, and really, a company like yours, increasingly, you're ticking off what are going to be the requirements of, the enterprise of the future, right? Which is more high volume logs, more custom applications, more custom logging, right? So like you pointed out, like very early on before we even got recording, it's not a case of storing and looking at firewall and router logs anymore, that, and with a enriched with a bit of CoreLite data. That's not what Seam is about in the future.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. And one of the things we've seen too is we've seen a gradual shift towards more security engineering and more technical chops in some of the personas, but it's not a full-on migration, everyone immediately picking up Python or SQL. And so that's something that we've observed. And why that's important is when you think about the makeup of certain security teams, the sort of security team of the future or some of the enterprises of the future that you mentioned, that's something that we're starting to see evolve. So we'll see a lot of our customers that jump in and they really start to do well are oftentimes those that are cloud native. They're doing a bunch of terabytes of data per month, sometimes even per day. And they have a sort of more, I would say, even-keeled approach in terms of security analysts and security engineers. It's more of a balanced team than you might see in a little bit older companies. And so that ultimately makes it so that they're looking for, okay, how can I have a SIM that allows me to do things that are a little bit more high leverage with my security engineers? So think about like, how can I deploy things like infrastructure as code type workflows for when I'm setting up different log sources? How can I make sure that I also have resilience that can also ultimately be built into more of like a CI/CD pipeline?
It's interesting that you're talking about basically terraforming a network to handle your logs. I mean, you're talking about a lot of logs here, right? Once you start needing to Terraform something, Terraform stuff to make that work.
Absolutely. We're talking about a significant number of logs, and we're talking about a lot of different custom logs as well. That's something that we've started to see a lot of different customers have, which is one of the things that actually, it sounds very maybe nuanced or niche, but it's actually really important when you're thinking about how do I get up and running and I'm not just sitting there and, mapping exercises to make sure that I have everything formatted the way that I need. And so that's an area that we actually do a pretty good job of getting folks up and running using things like inferring the schemas from the data, that sort of thing.
Yeah. But I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, it really is that data lake approach, but instead of just saying, throw it all in a data lake and then, I don't know, write some queries, that's up to you. You know, the idea is this is more of a tool set, isn't it, that can help people through that process of, storing things sensibly. And then, I mean, in terms of detections, you know, when you've got people using custom logs from custom applications, I imagine it's a little bit difficult for you as a SIEM vendor to have like pre-canned detections that they can run against those, data stores. So how does that work? Do you have like detection builders, or are there pre-canned ones that once you've stuffed their stuff into the, inferred the schema, there are still some pre-canned detections that'll work? Like, give us a indication of where the effort is there.
Yeah, so we see a lot of folks will use our out of the box detection content for sort of a jumping off point. So they'll look at that as almost like, okay, here's a boilerplate of what it might look like to view a failed login or look at when possibly there's data exfiltration in terms of just how would I actually look at and do a quick comparison. And so oftentimes they'll use our out of the box content to then jump into things that they want to do on their custom log sources. One of the nice things is we've started to simplify just how you can actually get your hands on and look at that data within the console so that you can start to look through examples really easily. And then one of the things that we've actually started to roll out is a new Python library that ultimately supports the way that we do detections. And that's really, really helpful when you think about, okay, I want to actually take something that Panther produced, and then I want to inherit from that certain conditional logic, but then I'm going to adapt it. And so that can work in certain instances. Like for example, if you're extending maybe different AWS rules that maybe we already produced, like an AWS ALB rule, for example.
Now I'd imagine too, and we're going to wrap it up shortly because we are running out of time, but I'd imagine that among your customer base would certainly be some of the Silicon Valley type of companies, right? Because everything that you're describing just makes me think of like the intro montage to the Silicon Valley TV show with all of those logos, right? Because they're the orgs that are going to use that. Is that about right for now, or are you seeing a lot of traditional enterprise as well?
That is right in terms of a lot of the folks that onboarded with us early are still with us. And a lot of what we've seen in terms of growth is with that type of cohort. They're much more familiar with just kind of the actual infrastructure. And oftentimes they've actually gone down the route of, we tried a homegrown solution and we realized it's a lot harder than maybe we thought in order to sit there and maintain that level of data ingestion, let alone build out a bunch of different connectors. And then that's not even taken into account all the downstream, which, then you're looking at a lot of, okay, I need to both write my detections, but then I also want to make sure that we actually have the time and capacity to think about how do we quicken the pace of being able to resolve alerts once they happen. And so that's where we have seen a lot of success with those type of kind of more forward-thinking high-tech companies.
Yeah, all right. Well, Casey Hill, thanks a lot for joining us to walk us through a bunch of that. It's really interesting stuff. I do find Panther really interesting. I think it's like one of those tools where the people who need it, they really do need it, which is always a good thing. But thanks a lot for joining us to walk us through all of that. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Patrick. Appreciate the time.
That was Casey Hill there from Panther. Big thanks to him for that. Big thanks to Panther for being this week's Risky Business sponsor, and you can find them at panther.io. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back on deck next week with Adam to do more Risky Business. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.